This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Staub Audio Engineering. If you have listened to any of the episodes, you have undoubtedly heard me talk about Mike and the phenomenal audio engineering work that he does. His mixes and masters are truly some of the best that I've ever heard. I love working with Mike on all of our Dreamfield tunes, on all of our Summit One tunes. He is an absolute wizard. Make sure to hit him up, inquire about mixing and mastering prices, and take your tracks to the next level. Oh, yeah. And Mike is also one of the nicest, kindest human beings you'll ever meet. Definitely hit him up and work with him.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of the producers, artists, and creators that are tuning into the show. My name is Cody Christensen, and you are listening to the Chilled Samples Podcast. Is going on, everyone. Welcome to the second workshop series. I'm joined here today with Thomas, mostly known as Docado Sounds, and Thomas is going to be showing us his guide to improving mixdowns, arrangements, and efficiency through templates. So with that, I'll kick it over to Thomas. How's everything going, man?
Amazing. Yes, great to be here, Cody. Lovely to be back on. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's going good, thank you. Yeah, it's been nice. Bit of a busy time at the moment, a bit of a crunch time. I think it's the same as kind of that Christmas period where there's a crunch up until the end of the year. I feel around kind of March, April, it's always a bit of a crunch with lots of different projects and work and stuff coming out before the summer. But it's a good time. We were just talking about having a healthy balance of being busy. A good busy.
Yeah, and I think that'll be a continued conversation that we share throughout the entirety of our music careers and our lives in general.
Exactly.
Continuously trying to find balance. And I think, yeah, Thomas, a great thing to mention is letting listeners know that you are a music educator. And a huge reason of why you're busy is from your current job.
That's it. Yeah. I'm just closing down some of my apps because I can hear my computer fan coming
okay.
on.
Was that, I was curious what that was. I was like, oh,
yes,
do I have cable
maybe
extension?
Have to use some RX to edit that out maybe.
Yeah.
I lecture at Leeds Conservatoire in the UK on the production and electronic music courses. So been doing that for, this is my third year, so still relatively new. And part of the busyness is I'm doing a teaching qualification in kind of how to teach higher education, which again is like a thing that just constantly keeps me on my toes, which is great. Constantly. I always think I learn probably more from the other students than they learn from me. But it's good to, yeah, it's really great to, just be in that environment, you know, and just kind of keep fresh, because I think as musicians we can just be very kind of solitary. So that kind of, it really keeps me engaged with what's happening.
and
learning from people.
Yeah, well, and I love what you said about the give and take relationship of learning from your students. And similarly, I think in regards to cementing and truly knowing information, teaching that information is the best way to solidify that knowledge within your own mind. I'm sure you've probably experienced that as well.
Totally, yeah. Unless you can't really, you can know something, but until you explain it, you have to be able to explain something and why you've done it a certain way. That's when you really know it. But I mean, a lot of the kind of higher education stuff is really interesting doing the qualification, because a lot of it is kind of, I think as I started kind of teaching and lecturing, the initial instinct is that it has to come from you. You're at the front of the classroom presenting this knowledge, but that's quite an outdated way of kind of learning. And I think especially with music, that's not how you learn, by someone just lecture at the front of the room. I think a lot of it is about kind of flipping it back around on the student and getting students to think about why they're doing things a certain way, as opposed to me kind of saying, this is how you do it. It's trying to flip it around more and allow students the kind of, it's like giving students the power to think for themselves, because when they leave uni, they're not going to have me or someone kind of just giving them information. So really interesting. And I think that's another great skill to have, of kind of something that you just strive to do anyway, that kind of self-education and trying to kind of constantly thinking about how you've got where you are, why you're doing certain things a certain way. Mm-hmm. Especially with something like music, it's so subjective. So hopefully this template session will A, help with if anyone's busy, it will speed that up. Mm-hmm. But also, take from it what resonates with you. And this is kind of my approach. But I mean, I guess this is a little bit more like a traditional lecture format in the sense of me just going against everything I just said and just speaking for an hour.
Well, but the great thing about this this episode is it can still be interactive, where if anybody that's tuning in has any questions, they can still mm-hmm. reach out to you and still get that engagement.
Absolutely.
And Tom,
sometimes it is nice. Sometimes it is nice just to have that format as well. And a lot of the time, some of the really useful sessions when I'm kind of lecturing are the unplanned ones, where you just talk for 2 hours with your students and listen to their mm-hmm. work and stuff. But sometimes that's the gold, where you're just kind of talking.
So what you said about reflecting on why you're doing something, this also may be a great opportunity for current listeners to pause and look at their current template and ask themselves, oh, wait, how long have I been using this template? When's the last time I updated it? Is there a better way to be able to create music more efficiently? And so hopefully this episode can serve as a reminder of that to some artists out there of hey, why are you doing what you're doing, and maybe give these strategies and tactics a thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Great segue into the main stuff. I think in terms of using templates, I think a lot of traditionally, obviously, in terms of mixdowns, you kind of receive audio stems and then you're kind of loading them in into your fresh Ableton or DAW session. And you would go about traditionally mixing all the elements together. The kind of mixdown process is completely separate from the composition and recording process. And I think as electronic musicians, that line is really blurred. A lot of the time, it's not a mix issue. It could be an arrangement issue. And I think as electronic musicians, we've got the kind of the power over that decision to, we can change the octave of the chords really easily if it's all in MIDI or, so the producer, I think, often takes on the role of the mixing engineer, that line is really, really blurred. So I think this idea of like mixing on the fly is sort of what kind of got me into the template thing, in terms of trying to set myself up to make it so I don't have to then start from scratch with the mix down as well. Because I think a lot of mix downs within electronic music and all music, it's a feeling. It's not really a technical process in a lot of ways. There's the technical elements to it, like automating your volume on your vocals and that kind of thing. But I think a lot of the time you do want to allow yourself you don't want to be thinking about the technical elements. You want to give yourself, let your ears just concentrate on what the music is doing. And templates can help with that. And there's also the benefit of when you've got a tight turnaround for a brief, an advert or something. Sometimes you can't go through the luxury of like mixing your track down in a traditional sense of bouncing the stems out. So Yeah, I think templates can help with speed as well, essentially. And I used to, there's the kind of question of, whenever I talk about this kind of thing, people seem to ask, do you bounce your stems out and kind of mix in separate sessions? Again, I think it's, there's no kind of right or wrong. If you're bouncing your audio, bouncing and working in audio, that is definitely an approach and that's what can work for people. I think I actually do it all in within one session, the whole mix down. Because for me, the mix down is sort of part of the, I'm making those decisions as I go, essentially. Yeah. And I think when you have to, when it comes to doing things like production music or music for sync, if you've got it all in the one session, you can quickly make kind of like 60-second edits and 30-second edits for film and TV and things like that. So personally, I do kind of, granted your CPU allows it, mixing in one session, I kind of go about that. But I know plenty of people that do just kind of bounce the stems out. And I think this idea of using templates, this kind of preparation, this side of things, you can use templates to mix as you go. And I think when people, when I kind of, when you're writing and composing, you can already be mixing. And I think that can come from using a template. So templates, I've already kind of said that the speed is one reason you might use them. You can, I think speed comes with a lot of benefits of being able to write objectively and quickly. And I think that has a number of benefits in terms of capturing an emotion and remaining objective, because your ears get tired. Oh, you've probably had it when you work on a mix and the next day you listen to it and it's like, even an hour later, and you're like, whoa, how did I not hear?
Yeah.
The drums aren't loud enough and or X, Y, Z. So I think templates can help you get into that flow state really quickly and maintain that creativity. Because again, a lot of the time, if you're constantly reaching for a compressor to sidechain something, why not have it set up ready to go? So you don't have to keep on reaching back. And I mean, there's loads of little things like that. So it's efficient as well. And it helps you with the kind of blank door syndrome, I guess. If you're, you know, templates aren't just for mixing, it's also for creating music. And I think I think the first workshop, Hoffy did talk about that as well in terms of creating a, I thought it was really interesting what he talked about. And I've gone away and done this myself as well, where if you've got a project and you want a sound within a project, creating a custom template with the sounds that you're going to use, and that helps keep the record consistent. So you can have your kind of template from a creation, a composition point of view as well.
Yeah, and shout out to Jonas for suggesting that, because it is such a brilliant idea to create essentially your color palette before you begin painting. And similarly, I follow the same strategy because I produce various types of electronic music, and so I have a different template for Crystal Grid, which is primarily future bass and dubstep, and then I have another template specifically for Zoa, which is mid-tempo. Same thing with Summit One, and then of course I also have a template that's purely audio tracks for stem collaborations. So
yeah,
just like you said, it's so beneficial to be able to use templates, not only for efficiency, but for that creative focus and creative direction.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there's so many things to think about with music. Like, even the last kind of point I've got written down is it just reminds you to do certain things. Like, I have a tuner on my kick drum channel just to go, oh, right. Yeah. I better just check that the tuning on my kick is somewhat lined up, because again, sometimes there's a lot of problems that can come from just your kick being like a semitone out if it's like more of a tuned kick. So things like that, it just reminds you to do certain things, I think, is also a kind of benefit of using them. 100%. And I think I kind of would highly encourage people to build your own templates. And it's all about, you know, I, like we said there, kind of constantly updating my template and It's kind of easy to have templates with different things, different projects. It's a constant learning process, as with anything. Updating your mix chains and stuff like that, you know, that's constantly going to be changing. So I think the first thing that I've kind of got written down is that I've, on my kind of template, is I'll have the channels ready to go. So I'll have kind of a kick channel, snare channel, hat channel, percussion channel, you know, a piano sound ready to go, the Labs piano just as a default kind of quick piano, melodic elements, harmony, the foundations of a composition, essentially. And it's not like you're going to use all of them, but it keeps you on track, I find. It keeps you from layering up too much, which is definitely my weakest thing, of I'll layer and layer and layer. And I think a lot of people do that. And again, a template has helped restrain me and go, well, I can only use these things, really. So, I will kind of have my instruments ready to go, which is kind of one side to it. And the next kind of thing is, that's the first stage. I've got my instruments laid out. And I actually pull all my volumes down to minus 10. So there's a difference, obviously, between gain and volume, which I'll kind of get onto. But my actual faders are turned down to minus 10. I've found it's not an exact science of why it's minus 10, but I found that that's a nice starting point, because if all your faders are at zero, and I know people in a traditional sense do the zero fader mix and kind of start from there, but if you wanted to make something 8 dB louder, you're capped at 6 dB, because above zero in Ableton, the faders don't go that loud. So if you treat minus 10 as your kind of midpoint, your zero, you've got so much room to go up and so much room to go down. And that means that you don't have to then start backtracking when your mix kind of gets summed up to the two bus and it's already like plus six, you know. So the first thing that I kind of did on my template is have it so everything is at minus 10 volume wise. Because you can always make something louder. You can just turn up the gain on the limiter or something. That's you're just turning volume up. And I just found myself getting frustrated with that thing of having loud mixes and then having to go back and readjust the levels. But then you readjust the levels and it throws the balance of the send channels off, or it sends the balance of other things off. So yeah, starting at that is really important. And then there's little tweaks. Like, as a general rule of thumb, I have my kick drum at minus 7, just because I find that I do always push that a little bit. Same with the snare. I have that just a touch louder. And because most samples are going to be normalized to kind of, you know, 0 dB. Mm-hmm. So I've found, as a general rule of thumb, having my kick just a little bit louder naturally places it where I've already made a mix decision there. I know just from doing it after a number of years that that's where I'll place my kicks. And obviously every kick is different. But that's where I found to be a good spot. Do stop me if I'm ranting at any point.
No, well, I think that's a great point. And I think just to even simplify the purpose, especially with utilizing templates and boosting efficiency, it's analyzing and recognizing what tasks or what processes do you repeat every single time that you create music, and then utilize your template so you don't have to continue to repeat those same actions, which just like you said earlier about pulling in a compressor for side chaining, if that takes 10 seconds for you to do, and you have to, you know, compound that by however many times that you do that for every single writing session, when it's something that you can just have inherent into your template, it's huge.
It really is. And it's that thing, you don't want to be breaking your creative flow. Because also mixing, like sidechaining, is equally, it's not a mixing thing, it's a compositional thing a lot of the time. It's part of the groove. It's part of the, you don't want to be kind of, you want to make that process as easy for yourself as possible. So there's this kind of like minus 10 idea where I've got my volume down at minus 10, but I actually also have a gain plugin as the first plugin on MIDI and audio, bringing the gain down to minus 10. So I've got this minus 10 on my volume and then minus 10 on the gain. And the difference there being that kind of gain is your input and volume being your output. And this might not be kind of super applicable, depends on kind of what plugins you're using, but a lot of kind of hardware or analog modeled plugins, like any of the UAD stuff or the Wave stuff, compressors and stuff weren't designed to have like 0 dB of gain kind of getting slammed into them. So you want to kind of bring that down before you're going into a compressor, because otherwise the compressor is not going to be able to deal with the amount of gain you're feeding into it. And a lot, you know, it's completely dependent on what you want to do, because sometimes you might want to drive a compressor and slam into it and get the tone of the compressor. So, you know, like I said, there's no hard and fast rules, but a lot of the time, my kind of experience is if you bring it down right at the start and you go through your processing, at the end, you can always add that 10 dB of gain back in. Yep. So I'll kind of save everything into a rack, and I'll have, it's kind of going in, I've got minus 10 gain, I do my processing, and then I can always make it louder at the end. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of got my processing that is like sandwiched by two gain plugins. and everything goes in between those gain plugins, and then I can kind of control the amount going in. And again, that can really help with, you know, cleaning your mixes up. If you've, you know, if you're kind of deliberately driving into maybe, like Ableton Saturator, sometimes you can be driving so much into it and you're wondering, why is it kind of sounding all horrible and distorted? Because you might be driving loads of gain into it without realizing it. And I think that's definitely a mistake that I made for quite a while. And again, now I don't even have to think about it. Like, it's just already in my template. And again, a lot of VSTs, you'll play a synth line and the gain coming out of it will be like 0 dB or like minus, you know, 0.-1 or something. And again, that means that you're starting to try and turn things down and it's all gets very messy. Whereas if you just bring it down at the start, you don't even have to kind of worry about it. So this minus 10 idea is like a kind of a golden rule that I've kind of noticed over time of just doing this process, you know, quite a lot. Minus 10 volume, minus 10 gain. Go on.
For your students that you're teaching, kind of what, when they learn this knowledge, what comments do they make about the improvements to their processes or mixdowns? Like what kind of revelations does it allow your students to have if they've had any?
Yeah, I think it's mainly that the mix process is way less frustrating, firstly, because they're not having to fight the master output of trying to bring things down then and then trying to rebalance things. You know, you might go, oh, it's a bit too loud, I'm going to bring everything down. But then if you're bringing the volume of everything down, sometimes that can change the balance of your sends, depending on how you've kind of set things up. So then your reverbs might be louder. You have to go turn them down and stuff like that. So I think the efficiency is a big thing. And it can help. I think the other thing is it helps people make more informed, conscious decisions of, okay, well, if I do want to drive something, I understand now that is a requirement of the gain that gets fed in. And I didn't know that for quite a while. And I think that can be a weird concept, because in Ableton or in Logic, gain staging isn't really a thing. You don't have to worry about it, really. That process comes from old kind of desks and having to drive the right amount of gain into the amp or into the into the desk to kind of get the right noise floor level. We'd have to really worry about that as electronic musicians, but I think that we should keep the concept because all the reasons that we just talked about. And it's one of those things where it's not gonna suddenly improve your mixes by like, it's not gonna be a magic thing, but it's a little step. And I think a lot of music production is little steps that add up to the final product being that little bit cleaner or dirtier if you want to drive the game more.
Truth. Yeah, it goes both ways.
But on the, that's actually a really nice point into why the whole minus 10 gain and volume thing works, because on a piece of hardware desk or like a hardware compressor, the way that volume and loudness is measured is different to Ableton. And in Ableton, we kind of measure things I always forget the dBFS, full decibels full scale, which is like a exact digital recording of the exact loudness in that exact moment. And again, like on analog, you can't measure, there's nothing that can measure that quickly. So the way that that is measured is on a VU meter, and you've probably, a lot of kind of compressors and old style things have this VU meter. And zero on a VU meter is kind of what the healthy level of your mixing and to feed into a compressor or a saturator. That's seen as like the nice level to kind of feed in at this zero VU. And that equates to minus 18 decibels kind of on RMS value, which is again like an average volume. I know this is like getting a little bit mathsy, but we don't have to really go into it, but the point is that minus 10 thing on the whole adds up to equate to this nice healthy mix volume that people have worked to for, you know, since the recording began. So that's the kind of reason behind it. It kind of lines up with the analog world. And I think there's some nice things that you can bring over from the analog world, that those rules where it's like 90% of the time, yeah, you want to stick to that. Again, maybe you want to slam into the VU meter to get the tone of a compressor. That's, you know, do that.
Yeah.
But knowing why you're doing it, as opposed to trying to fight it. Like, why is my kick drum so distorted and how do I fix it? It might be because you're slamming into all the processing, you know. So yeah, there's a free VU meter by TB Pro Audio. If you're, because Logic has Ableton's not got a VU meter. And if you kind of a healthy point for mixing and then mastering is if your entire mix is hitting this kind of zero mark on a VU meter, that is a really nice healthy mix. And if you've done the minus 10 thing all the way throughout the mix processes, you'll probably be hitting that zero on a VU meter as a rule of thumb. And that means you've got a really nice, healthy mix level. It's not too loud. If you're sending it to a mastering engineer, it'll be probably a nice level. So yeah, there is a kind of a technical reason. For this minus 10 thing. Sorry, that's a lot of numbers.
No, well, and it's important to have that intentionality. And similarly, there's been a lot of years, and there's so much knowledge that I still don't know. But I used to, like, when I first, let's just say the first 2 years I had Ableton, you know, I was kind of just doing whatever I wanted without understanding what I was doing. And there's creative freedom in that sometimes. And I love what you were saying about slamming into your process, because there's a lot of time if I'm making a really nasty dubstep track or a really nasty mid-tempo track, well, sometimes it's fun to slam into those meters because those are the distorted, formant-filled sounds that I'm going for.
That's it.
But the knowing why is important, just in case you do want to just have that intentionality behind it.
Yeah, I always love Mr. Bill for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you ever watch, like, you know, he's like, okay, I've got a sine wave. And he's like, right, what we're going to do is take OTT and duplicate it 100 times.
Yep.
And it's like, well, yeah, that's kind of like creative sound design. And then there isn't kind of rules there.
Mm-hmm.
Or like I said, yeah, like I've just done I've got a project coming out in June with my friend Mountain Range. And the whole concept of that is that we have kind of, you know, you look at the mix bus processing and the kind of technical part of me wants to cry because it's so overcompressed and some of the EQ moves are absolutely wild.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all kind of, and it's fun to do that. It's definitely fun to do that. But I think it's the classic thing of, like, you know, same with like music theory. It's like you do have to know the basics to understand why to not do it. And if you don't know that kind of stuff, then you'll probably hit a point where you get frustrated, because when you do need to know how to do it, you hit that wall. And it's the kind of same with like mixing, as I think, as well.
It's fun. Yeah. It's fun to, it's fun to experiment with breaking the rules, but you need to know the rules first before you can break them.
Yeah, it's the classic, the classic kind of thing that people always say. And then you hear someone say that and you're like, oh, I don't want to learn the rules. but I think it is good. So that's the kind of first thing. I've got my channels and I've got the minus 10 thing going on. Alongside that, on every channel, I have like a basic rack, which includes things like a sidechain ready to go, compressor ready to go. I have an EQ set up, and literally just the EQ8 in Ableton. No need to kind of use anything more than that. Cutting everything below 100, apart from the kick and the sub channel. So I have the sub kind of everything below 100 there, and then the bass everything above 100. Again, you know, depending on the type of music, some people have like go even further and they have mid basses and top basses. Yeah. For more kind of bass heavy music. And then you know, that again, that's changed since I used to have a saturator on everything. when I first just fell in love with saturation, I just put saturation on every single thing. And then I realized my mixes sounded a little bit kind of like there was too much excitement because I just saturated everything. So, you know, it changes, but the staple is having an EQ and that kind of sidechain compressor ready to go. And then, like I said, a gain plugin at the end of the chain. And that also has a great function of being able to automate the gain instead of automating the faders, which is, again, just a kind of an ease of life thing where you can use gain to automate at the end, and that leaves your faders free. Just to, if you want to just bump up the whole drums, nudge that fader up. That's kind of, again, just a habit that I've got used to doing. Automate using the gain plugin at the end of the chain as opposed to the faders.
Yeah, and Thomas, do you know why Ableton would design the faders to not adjust the volume automation, if that makes sense? So if you're doing the volume automation on the faders, but you just mm-hmm. want that track to go up by 1 dB,
mm-hmm.
Why do you think Ableton doesn't allow that to also adjust your volume automation?
Are you saying kind of like if you automated the volume and then you do just want to nudge it up by 2 dB, it kind of mm-hmm. snaps back to the automation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I guess that's just, volume faders aside, that is just automation in general. It's going to be, you kind of need it to snap back to where, if it's a filter cutoff, you wouldn't want to change. I know exactly your point, and I think that would be a great feature of Ableton, to be able to independently adjust the parameter without affecting the automation.
Exactly.
That would be great, but it doesn't exist. But unless there is maybe another door has that feature, which is a really great feature.
Yeah.
There is a technical reason as well that I forgot to mention, as opposed to on your faders, the further down you go, the resolution starts to get smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So in Logic, for example, if you go below, I can't remember the exact number, let's say it's 12, it would go from like 12.1 to minus 12.2, minus 12.3. Eventually it starts just jumping in whole numbers and you lose detailed control. And whereas with a game plugin, you've always got that, you know, you've always got that resolution. And that sounds really particular, but it's like, and here's another thing where it's easy for me to kind of say this, but sometimes you generally can hear the difference of like 1 dB and or half a dB. And sometimes you want to be that precise.
Yeah.
And if you can't because your fader's too far down, then it's just a little bit annoying. So you'd have to then use the gain. So keeping it with a gain plugin just means you've got that resolution kind of all the time, really. I mean, but there is no reason why you couldn't just kind of if you wanted to make something louder, you could just stick a gain plugin at the end and just bump it up by 3. But again, it's, you know, it's just how you've set it up. It's kind of nice just to have your faders free to make those master decisions. So it's kind of a workflow thing as well. But once you've got your basic rack set up in Ableton in specifically, and you can do this in Logic as well, and I imagine most stores, but you can have it set up so that when I add a new audio or MIDI channel, all of that stuff is already loaded in. So it loads up as minus 10, it loads up as with the gain, it loads up with all my basic processing on it. And in Ableton, you literally just right-click your channel once you've got it set up and hit save as default. And it will save that MIDI channel and audio channel as default. And that's actually the same with plugins as well, which I didn't know. So in Ableton 11, they changed the layout of the compressor. And it really threw me off because I use just the first view. But if you set it up how you want, you can hit right-click save as default and it will load up how you want it to load up every time, which is...
I didn't know that, man.
Yeah, it's really handy. It's really handy. Yeah. So I have my compressor load up with the sidechain ready to go because I got fed up of opening the window and sidechaining it and, you know, so on. And then once you've got your channels laid out, it also makes that super easy because you can just go, I know that my kick drum is always going to be in the same place. You don't have to go scrolling through drum racks and that kind of thing. So once it works, it all starts to link together in a really cool way.
And Thomas, I apologize for any background noise. They're cleaning up my neighbor's trees, and it sounds like there is a wood chipper going on. So similarly, I'm going to have to do a little RX on my channel for post-processing, which is A-okay. But back to you, my friend.
I can't hear it. I can't hear it anyway, okay. So we're all good. I should preface this with saying I know this stuff isn't the most exciting stuff to talk about in terms of, you know, it can be quite dry in terms of putting a gain on everything. But it really does come into its own when you start being able to... Anything that can just help you maintain that creativity, by my extent, is amazing if you can kind of set that up. So, yeah. And then just a few little extras, obviously... Different channels will have different quirks. So having a tuner on the kick drum and then having drum bus on my drums group.
Yep.
Because it's like every time you want to put drum, I always put drum bus on my drums because it just makes them pop out a little bit more. I love drum bus plugin in Ableton. It's just the way that it's, you know, really it is just kind of saturation and compression, but there's something going on underneath the hood that just makes it sound great. So kind of have that ready to go because I always use that. So having like a separate sidechain channel at the top if you ever want to kind of have a different ghost sidechain pattern, things like that. So having that ready to go set up. And yeah, having those default sounds ready to kind of start so you can just lay down your ideas. So that's all the kind of the you've got your instruments and the channels of those instruments set up. There's things like two bus processing, like your mixed bus processing. And that is, I guess, quite a personal thing, I think, in terms of what you... It can really define your sound, I think, having your the way your that you work into processing or not. Personally, I've made the creative decision to not work into any processing whatsoever during the initial stage. And I know that's, you know, it's just a case of some people work into a limiter and it's like so they can hear it kind of how it's going to sound and super loud. And there's that kind of argument. Some people mix into, like, work into a compressor to kind of glue things together. I just personally like to kind of work unaltered. So, because I found that sometimes if you start boosting things, you can then start slamming into the compressor or limiter without realizing it. And then you're fighting yourself to work backwards from there. Which I kind of got frustrated with a little bit. So I actually stop. During my mix process, eventually I do put on mixed bus processing, and a lot of mixing, a lot of my mixing is tied together, really glued together by my mixed bus processing. But for the arrangement and the creating, I kind of don't work into anything. But that is just a personal decision. Some people do, and that's like, yeah, it's just depends what you... If you're making really heavy music, maybe you probably do want to mix the work into a limiter to kind of hear it loud and a little bit crushed.
Yeah, well, and it's I think it's just a continuation of what we talked about earlier of knowing the rules and then breaking the rules, but also figuring out like why you're doing why you're taking a particular action. And so I produce just a glue compressor and EQ8, and I've done that for years, and so even as we're going through it, it's like, oh, why do I do that? And it is just to glue everything together. But I haven't asked myself if that's useful to my process. It's just something that I've done forever.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that might be if that's how it kind of works in your workflow. Then there's some points where it's like, well, don't change that. Maybe just kind of at least you kind of know. I mean, I'm sure that's just kind of subtly just gluing it together, which in the end is what you want to do anyway. So if that's kind of, you know, how it works with you, then again, it's like absolutely cool.
And I'm not sure if it is. So it's that question of like, oh, why am I doing that? Maybe I should answer that question and figure out if I want to update my process and my workflow.
That's it. Yeah. There's like little things I have, like I've mapped the button next to the one on a Mac keyboard. I never know what that's called. It's like a weird S. It's like two S's laid on top of each other. I map that to mono. So the only thing that I have on my mix bus is a mono plugin to begin with. And I just flick that. It's just the utility plugin in Ableton, sorry. So I can quickly check my mixes in mono. Again, used to be obsessed with trying to make my mixes sound good in mono. I've realized that with like the more ambient textural stuff that I do, it's never going to sound great in mono because it's so wide. All the reverbs and delays are so wide, and I kind of had to just go, you know what, I'm not going to spend ages trying to make it sound good in mono. Again, if I was writing house club music, I would make it sound great in mono. And make sure that I'm not, it doesn't disappear in mono. But yeah, kind of a little thing there. and then, so the next kind of thing that I have set up is a reference, at least three reference channels inside a kind of reference group. I think reference tracks are like some of the most important things, tools to learn from, from like an arrangement point of view, from a mix point of view, from a mastering point of view, because you can kind of, if you're not using reference tracks, no matter how good you are, you still, I don't think I'll ever like trust my own ears. Yeah. In the sense of kind of first sound quality, I trust my ears musically, and I trust my ears, you know, in terms of making the right, you know, the stylistic composition and mix decisions. But when it comes to, you know, releasing commercial music and or any kind of music, using a reference track, I just think, is so important to guiding you in terms of where to place things. And because, like I said, you know, you can get used to how a kick drum sounds in a track, and it just takes that what listening to a similar sounding track and then go, oh wow, I just need to turn that down a little bit. And I think a little note on reference tracks is that I think whenever I seem to tell students about it, a common, I don't want to say mistake, because it's not a mistake, but a common thing people say is, well, I can't find a reference track that sounds like my track. And I think the key thing is it doesn't have to sound like your track at all.
Yeah.
It's just the tone. It might be a completely different genre, but if you love the tone of the record, that's way more important, I think. There was a mix with the Masters video. I can't remember who the mixing engineer was, but he was making like a soul pop track, and his reference track was like a math rock track.
Yep.
Completely different, but he was just like, I love the tone of this record, and that's what I'm aiming for. And I thought that was great, because really thinking about it way more musically than technically.
Yeah.
So that's always really stuck with me. But yeah, you having kind of, again, a group of references, like, oh, right, now it's time, I better load in my reference tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that using your, is again, different in every door, but making sure your reference tracks aren't feeding through your mix bus processing or your master chain, because that's going to change the tone of them, obviously. So kind of in Ableton, I set it out by just setting the output to exterior 1 and 2, and that will bypass your master. You can, if you're using maybe like groups and sends, you know, there's different ways of setting it up. So there's no right way. In Logic, you're going to be probably setting up a bus, a two bus, and it's just knowing the concept that you don't want your references to be running through your kind of glue compressor or your EQ. Yep. Again, a mistake that I made kind of initially of why does this not sound how it sounds on iTunes?
Yeah. Well, and it's, that's such a great point as well. And I did that for a lot of years until I realized I'm running it into my master's.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's it. And you're like, oh no, shouldn't be doing that. That is a rule where it's like, there's no real reason to break that rule.
Yes. True.
Really. You know, I can't think of a reason why you'd want to hear a track run through your master processing. And the only thing is like a match EQ, but again, that's not the same. But yeah. And then, so we've kind of got all that stuff. Next thing is the sends and returns, having them set up. Again, really personal. I kind of have, I use them as a checklist. I have drum parallel pressure, like a drum parallel send set up, a bass parallel, mix parallel if I want to do any mix kind of parallel compression or distortion, a short reverb, a long reverb, a delay. You can get, some people have like even eighth note delays set up and quarter note and triplet delays set up. If you're making like, I've got a lot of my students make kind of UK dubstep,
mm-hmm.
Like kind of banger, scream, proper UK dubstep. And a lot of that kind of dub, you know, the delays are equally a part of the composition. They're really fundamental. So they'll have kind of all the delay times set up on sends. And it's more like they use Ableton in more as like a, they're making like dub edits and really interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, really, really cool. So yeah, really. And again, that's just super creative way of using sends as a compositional thing. But again, I use them more as like a functional like thing to check. Again, having an EQ on my reverb. So I'm in a sidechain. So I'm like, oh, don't forget to sidechain the reverb if I want to, because otherwise I'll forget.
Yep.
So it's little things like that, and it's like you're just constantly adding to that. And then, I mean, that's kind of like all the fundamentals. A lot of the instrument. One little tip is a lot of the instruments that I use. Maybe on my, let's say I've got like a harmony channel. I compose first with sine waves, so I just have wavetables set up, and a lot of the chords and the melodies initially will be I write with a sine wave, purely to because I feel like if it's working with a sine wave, it will sound good with any patch.
Yeah.
So that I kind of don't have kind of pre-made things loaded up in terms of like SAP specific patches or anything. I just have wavetable and everything. Apart from my piano, I kind of have that. But I'll kind of have that right with sine waves, which is a bit of a, I don't know if that's a particular good, or I don't know if I'd recommend that really. I'd say that's quite a extreme limitation to just write with sine waves the initial parts. But I found that it really helped. The arrangement was, my arrangements became cleaner as a result of me doing that, because it forced me to, you know, if I've got a melody and a chord progression, if they're different patches, but sometimes if they're in the same frequency range and I've not arranged them very well, sometimes sound design can hide the fact that they're quite muddy. You can get excited by the synth preset and forget about the fact that actually your melody is just sitting right in where your chords are sitting. Whereas with a sine wave, you can really hear it because it stacks up quite in a not pleasant way sometimes.
Yeah.
So that just reminded me of that. So I think that's a kind of. That actually leads on to the next kind of the point is that I think using the template can help with getting the sound right at the source. It's the same thing as if you were miking up like a guitar or something. You wouldn't kind of just stick an SM58 kind of just like 3 feet away from the cab and say, yeah, sounds good. or it doesn't sound good, but we'll fix it in the mix. We'll just fix it later in the mix. Same kind of thing with the composition and the sound design. Organizing your, and this kind of goes into the similar idea with templates, like organizing your sample library so that you're choosing the right samples. That is all kind of part of the same thing as well. Same kind of mindset. And there maybe shifting a little bit away from templates, but yeah, choosing the right samples, sample selection is so important. Again, if you can kind of organize your sample library, probably the thing that most producers just hate doing. I kind of think that's the same thing as a template in a way. You're setting your folders up right. You don't want to get frustrated and bogged down by trying to choose what the right samples. If you know your sample library, like you should be like a librarian of your own sample library.
Totally.
And just know instantly, oh, that's where my Foley loops are.
Yeah.
Boom. Yeah.
I love that analogy. That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah. I mean, it's so true that you, and also, especially when you're working with other people, you know, if someone's like there behind you and you're scrolling through sounds, it's just not inspirational, is it? So using that kind of template kind of it just keeps me on track, and a lot of my tracks now it will do, and this sounds really simple and it sounds so simple to state, but they are just drums, bass, percussion, a melody part, a harmony part, some guitars, maybe a vocal sample, and then maybe texture. And like those eight things, that is my template pretty much. And it's so easy to then start going beyond that and layering and layering and layering. But it's exactly the same thing. I think of it as a band. Your template are your musicians,
Yep.
That is what you're working with. You know, yes, obviously, if I'm like, I really want a second melody part, but if I'm like, oh, it's not on my template though, I'm not going to, can't possibly add that in. Of course, I don't kind of stop to that degree, but it's a good kind of initial rule, I think, of using kind of your template. Yeah. And then I guess to kind of start just a few kind of final things, in this kind of theme of using your template and setting yourself up as your mix is your arranging, your template is kind of doing your arrangement in terms of just your, not your structure, but I mean, you can even have structure templates as well if you kind of wanted to. But your arrangement is, your template is dictating your structure, your arrangement, sorry. And you're kind of making mixed decisions with the minus 10 rule in to some degree. Obviously, everything is not going to be at minus 10 and you start kind of making tweaks there. But I wanted to kind of set my template out where I come to mix a track. Really, then the mixing just becomes about what problems can I hear? And it's not me starting from zero with the kick drum and bringing everything else in, because you're kind of doing that as you go. You've got your reference track loaded in, so you can kind of start doing that as you go as well. And I really think that now it's like when it comes to mixing, it literally is, I'll have my mix chain set up and my master chain, which I can briefly talk about, but it then just becomes about what problems can I hear? And then if there's no issues, then in my eyes, the mix is done then. And I think because that can really be an issue of, you know, spending so much time on a mix and because I've done it where the demo sounds better than the mix, because I've ruined the energy of the mix by trying to go through all these mix processes of, I need to compress everything and now I need to EQ everything, where a lot of the time you can just kill the energy of a track.
Yeah,
I think and that was a real and that I still do it. I still overmix things. I still kind of deliberately, I'll use a new plugin that you just got. Soothe and Gullfoss for me, those plugins. I put it on everything. I just destroyed the energy of, I used Soothe and I took out so much resonant frequencies that it sounded unnatural.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's another brilliant point, is to not overdo it and to have that relative trust in your ears. If it sounds good, it is good. And that's that's just a constant balancing act. And similarly to everything that we're discussing in regards to organizing your samples and creating your template, well, being cognizant that you're not spending so much time on template creation that you're not actually writing music.
That's so true. So true. Yeah. It requires like an initial investment, you know, it doesn't even take an hour really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe an hour to kind of put it together and think about the things that you always do, but it can just be something that you continuously add to as you write a track, you know? But yeah, that's so true. Like not getting too caught up in the process of actually creating loads of templates and then not actually writing any music. I think for me, like mixing, it's kind of like I'll group things up into like five channels: drums, bass, percussion, harmony, melody, effects. And then I'll just do very broad strokes across those things, and just adding a bit more kind of, again, maybe I'll compress the groups, like the master groups ever together just a little bit, just to kind of glue them. Very subtle stuff, nothing kind of crazy. Even then though, I've got pre-made, in terms of Ableton, pre-made audio effects racks. You know, number one is my group processing. So I've got it laid out. So I'm like, cool, now I need to mix the track, group it all together. What's the first thing? Do all my group processing. Number two is drum parallel. Number three is bass parallel. Number four is my mix parallel chain. And I've literally got a set of mixing audio effect racks, which are the numbered, which just go through my process of mixing down. And again, they're kind of templates within themselves of pre-made chains. It's like a gentle reminder. Within those things, I've got effects that I don't use. You know, sometimes, as an example, I've got like the Plugin Alliance Mag 4 EQ, which has the 40k boost, which is really nice for adding a bit of sizzle. Again, not every track is going to need 40k boost because it's more of a kind of a pop thing, but sometimes it's like there's a reminder, shall I add that in? Most of the time it's no, but it is I just really like that EQ. But it, you know, it's the same process within my mix chains. I've got a template of contained within the audio effects racks kind of laid out. When I go to my in Ableton, you've got the favorites. I think the purple one is my mixing thing, and I have numbered the mix process essentially. And again, like, so that is kind of to kind of round things off there. That is, they're mini templates in themselves, and I'm kind of, I don't have to think, what do I need to do now? Do I need to process the drums? Do I need to, I'm kind of just following a guide, my own set of guidelines. And it just makes the mix, because I hate mixing. I really hate the process of mixing. I try it. So if I can make it quicker and efficient, that I can, that I only have to really go through this process, you know, relatively quickly within like an hour or two, then that's, a good thing. to stop myself from over mixing.
Just so we can, just like we talked about earlier, allowing you the time and energy to focus on the creation process rather than the mundane and repetitive tasks. But Thomas, thank you for sharing your insight and your knowledge with all of us. You definitely have a wealth of information that that you shared within this episode. And I know for me, there's already already notes that I jotted down for me to double check within my own process. And I know any artist out there that is listening, that listened all the way through has undoubtedly pulled some gained knowledge to go and double check. And, Thomas, truly it's a pleasure to have you on, and I'm grateful that you're willing to share your knowledge and expertise with all of us, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, just to kind of, double down the fact that, If you're kind of disagree with something that I say, that's great. If you can kind of justify what, do you know what I mean though? It's like, do the opposite of everything that I've said and then see what doesn't or what does work. And then, don't kind of take, anyone's word as gospel, because, it's all about forming your own opinions. But hopefully that was useful. And if you've got any questions, please do just reach out. I'll kind of answer them, hopefully.
Awesome. Well, hey, Thomas, thanks again, man. Truly, we're lucky to have you in the community, and we're lucky that you're so gracious and willing to serve the community with the knowledge that you have. That's huge, and we can't thank you enough, man.
I think that comes from a frustration of wishing that someone had told me and avoiding making like 10 years of mistakes.
Well, you're able to push the careers forward of so many artists by sharing your knowledge gain from those 10 years of mistakes. And I can definitely resonate with you on that, man. But yeah. Thomas, thanks again, man. We have some exciting stuff coming up soon. So we'll be back with another episode shortly.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Of course, Thomas. Thank you.